Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
Welcome back to the weekly roundup on the dialogue with Diwa de Boer and William McGimsey on Reality Check Radio. It is the 29th week of the year, and what a week it has been. Welcome to the show, William.
Thanks, Diwa. It's good to join you again.
And we have been starting with international news recently, but there's really only one piece of international news that has trumped all other pieces of international news and domestic news as well. And it happened nearly a week ago now. And so we can, I guess, reflect on how it's developed a little bit as well. But the attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump took place Sunday New Zealand time, or Saturday in America, I believe. And it was pretty close, wasn't it?
Yep. They got him in the ear, and he only just tilted his head just in time to avoid the bullet. The thing he was looking at was, of course, a poster illustrating the very high immigration rates, the border crossing, an immigration poster. So his focus on immigration in that instant literally saved his life.
Yes, for those of you who have been on social media, particularly Twitter, I don't know if there are other places where this has been posted, but there is basically a sort of 3D reconstruction of the path of the bullets and Trump moving his head. And it was, you know, just 0.3 seconds and a few centimeters away from death. He just moved his head right as the bullet came past and it clipped his ear. It's quite a miraculous thing. Divine intervention, I would say. And I've definitely seen other people attribute things like the wind. There was a little bit of a crosswind, but that counts as divine intervention. So I'll chalk it up to that.
Yeah. And what his reaction was the perfect reaction politically. I mean, we should just say that this is a terrible thing that's happened. America has been known to have assassinations and assassination attempts of its presidents, but it's a terrible thing that's happened. But I just wanted to premise with that, because I'm just going to say the way Trump reacted to the assassination attempt was perfect political reactions, perfect political instincts. He stood up. He told his security detail to wait, and then he clenched his fists, raised it in the air, said "fight, fight, fight," and the crowd cheered as he walked away. And the photos that were taken off the back of that incident were spectacular, and they're going to live in America. It's going to be a big part of America's political history, I think, moving forward. People will never forget that. His reaction in particular has had the effect of, I think, at this point, it looks like galvanizing support behind him and making his election. It's still a wee while away. Other things can still happen, but it seems like it's making his re-election very likely.
Yeah, as you mentioned, this is a bad development in politics in America. You did say that it has happened a few times before in America, and certainly not the first time that a candidate or a president has been shot in America. But yeah, it's particularly with regards to Trump, it's been a very, very bad development, I would say, because the way that he's been framed as being the enemy of democracy, the sort of the ultimate evil threat. He's been described continually by him as an existential threat to the country. And so, yeah, an attempted assassination puts the American political sphere in a very difficult place, especially in the past, where assassinations or attempted assassinations have sort of resulted in galvanizing the entire country, say, behind a particular candidate, and you've seen landslide elections and so on. This still looks like it's going to be close. It's almost like it doesn't change anybody's mind. It's like, oh yeah, that, you know, candidate just got shot, and instead of it changing the outcome into a massive landslide, you might still just see a close swing, like a very small swing towards Trump, instead of say 10 points, maybe 1 or 2 points. And that may be enough to secure his victory, but just the point of no return almost that American politics has reached. And whether we can say it has reached that point or it's nearly reached that point, some people may say that we're well beyond that point now, and but that certainly is very concerning. And I was talking with Brendan Malone about this, about republics having a shelf life, and republics tend not to live very long before they dissolve. And it feels a little bit like the American Republic is in its late stage.
Yes. I mean, this is the issue, right? People need to have something in common when all the political differences are said and done and put aside. There needs to be some sort of shared culture, shared values, shared traditions, shared religion that holds the people together and makes the political differences not an existential problem, not a matter of friend and foe, but a matter of a disagreement over correct public policy. And this is the problem in America and most of the other Western liberal democracies at the moment, is that the range of political views, the spectrum of political views is so big, and that the view of the good life that the different parts of this society have, that people on the right and the people of the left, they have such different views of, you know, the role of government, the role of society, what the good life looks like, that they're diametrically opposed. And for one to have their way would necessarily mean the extinction of the culture and the way of life of the other. And so that's just too broad a range of differing worldviews to live together within the same society. And I think that this is a good, avoiding this sort of thing happening in the first place is one of the reasons why nationalism is sort of necessary, because it's too great a range of, you know, different views on the good life, different views on how society should be structured, different philosophical and religious systems for them all to live together into the same country or under the same system. So we need to have a diversity of systems and a world governed by a array of sovereign states allows for that diversity of different systems to exist. And so it allows for a greater range of human societies and human types to coexist. This is one of the most important arguments for nationalism, I think. But the key point and my key takeaway from the the Trump assassination attempt is a sort of meta-political takeaway. So for a long time, we've been used to, you know, people on the left having mainstream media dominance, and they're always able to frame the, rhetorical tensions rising as being driven by people on the right. And so, Trump is blamed by mainstream media for raising rhetorical tensions. And it's never the left-wing people who are calling him, you know, racists and sexists and xenophobes and homophobes and all the words, or far right, or, you know, extremist. They never hold themselves accountable. They're never held accountable for raising the rhetorical tensions by using those labels. But that is really, I think, what probably drove the shooter. We don't know that for sure, and it's speculative. But I think it's a wee bit coincidental that a lot of the details of the shooter remain unavailable to us. And I think that's could probably be caused by the fact that he was radicalized basically by the mainstream media, as a lot of people in our contemporary society are, against ideas that really aren't that far right or aren't that extreme. Yet they are labeled far
right. Everybody believed these things 5 minutes ago. These are things everybody believed until just the last few years, the last few decades, and the mainstream media has completely rewritten what are normal things and what normal things people are allowed to believe.
Yeah, and they label this sort of thing stochastic terrorism when, you know, people on Twitter or other individuals do it. What they're doing is they're systematically raising the tensions in society by the way they're framing their political foes as radical and dangerous and extreme, that it makes violent events like this much more likely to occur. And that's what they've done for a half a century now with political correctness. They've systematically sought to delegitimize the conservative half of the political spectrum, the conservative worldview, by demonizing it with all these politically correct labels as racist, sexist, homophobe, extreme, far right, radical extremist. and that rhetorical strategy is having its predictable result in tearing society apart and making these acts of violence more likely. What political correctness really is, in my view, is it's an anti-traditional and anti-Western set of moral and cultural norms that are being imposed on our society in a top-down way in order to delegitimize and demoralize the normal traditional views. So if you think that the man should be the head of the household, that's sexism, you know, and if you adhere to traditional religious views on homosexuality being immoral, then that you're a homophobe. If you are a patriot and you take your own nation's side, then you're a racist and you're a xenophobe. And on it goes with all these words. All these words delegitimize the normal, traditional, conservative views and values and intuitions of ordinary people. It's the opposite of free speech. It's the opposite of free and open debate, of discussing your differences and coming to a resolution. It's a rhetorical strategy designed to delegitimize, demonize, and shut people up. And it results in violence if you do that systematically and you control all of the media. So I condemn the mainstream media across the Western world for doing this systematically for 50 years. You've torn the greatest societies in the world apart. You're inciting violence. You need to put a stop to doing things this way.
Speaking about ordinary conservative people, I should mention at this point as well that the attempted assassination of Trump did result in the actual murder of one of the members of the crowd. And there's a man by the name of Cory Contemporor, and he was killed while protecting his family, shielding them with his body. And he was hit by the shooter, and there were several others who were injured critically, but Cory was the one who was killed. And the crowd on the whole as well stayed relatively calm. Most of them ducked for cover. They ducked to cover their family and their loved ones. And as you mentioned, you know, when Trump raised his fist and yelled fight and so on, the crowd stood up with him as well. And they were there even when they were being shot at. The ordinary conservatives of rural America stayed calm under, you know, what would be the most intense pressure and chaos. And that was, I think, quite commendable. And you could see it in the man who was killed, that's the kind of ordinary people who are there for Trump, and those are his supporters. That's his base, these family men who would, you know, take a bullet for their loved ones.
Yeah, everything we know about the man who was killed suggests that he was a very good father and a very good person. And he died, from what we understand, trying to defend his family. So, I mean, there's nothing more noble than that. And it's a very sad thing that he had to die. But yeah, this is it's an interesting point. I think Trump reacted with physical courage, and as the crowd did, as you say. But Trump's whole political career has been characterized by a different sort of courage. It's the courage to say things that are unsayable. It's the courage to go against the grain. The courage to say what needed to be said, to take a risk, a political risk, and to do it despite all the wise heads and all the consultants, all the political strategists, all the upper classes being against those things being said. And he did it, and it needed to be said, and he got elected off the back of it. He's likely going to be elected again. And regardless of whether Trump is actually able to implement the policy agenda that he's set out, I mean, I hope he is able to, but even if he hasn't, his lasting legacy will be that he's acted like a bulldozer to political correctness, and he's allowed us to say things that were rendered unsayable, but that needed desperately to be said in order to point out, discuss, and solve important problems that are happening in society.
You've already hinted at a little bit of sort of coalescence around Trump, especially from his own side. His own base is that the broader Republican Party has really come behind him after this assassination attempt. But when it comes to the elites, there have been a few who have come out publicly and endorsed him. Now, Elon Musk, I believe, was the first to say that he openly endorsed Trump. And then you had a number of other sort of people who were in a similar group to Elon Musk, and a number of these men who started PayPal are incredibly wealthy, and we'll get back to them in a minute. But it was, I believe, David Sachs and the Winklevoss twins and Anderson as well, and a few others whose names escape me at the moment. But you had all of these very, very wealthy men, some of the richest men in America, billionaires from Silicon Valley. So the new billionaires were those who got rich after the year 2000, and they're looking to shape America. And they have come out now behind Trump as kind of a counter-revolution, a counter-elite, who are willing to say, we support Trump, we'll give him the funding, we'll bankroll the personnel who could make a difference. And it seems like Trump's personnel issues are basically going to be resolved, or at least there are very important people, very intelligent people who are solving this problem now that Trump has had with personnel, and they're lining up people to fill the roles and to clear out the bureaucracy. And it seems especially these new billionaires, these younger billionaires who basically want to get more stuff done. And currently in America, they see that things are broken. The bureaucracy is so bad. The diversity programs are so bad that they can no longer get the technological progress that they want. And these guys are sort of futurists. They want to go boldly into the future. They want to conquer the solar system. They, some of them are pursuing transhumanism and so on, which I definitely don't endorse, but I'm just giving you a picture of people who are pushing for technological progress. And they're seeing that the social progress, as it were, is getting in the way. And they're now coming in very strongly behind Trump in the wake of this assassination attempt.
Yeah. Well, what Trump is really trying to do is lead a sort of a revolution of sorts, a revolution against the status quo.
We'll call it a counter-revolution. That's the conservative way to refer to it. We're not revolutionaries, but we're counter-revolutionaries.
I like your way better. That's right. And, as I've discussed with you before, power is not equally distributed amongst all members of society. Power is distributed according to a bell curve, and there are always people in society who have more power and people who have less. It's very difficult to overturn the norms and the institutions and the systems of governance and institute a new status quo in society if you've got none of the elite on your side. And Trump, it seemed in 2016 when he ran, had very few of other powerful and important individuals and groups in America on his side. And still now, that you would have to say that the bulk of the power structure is against them. But there is a faction of the power structure now which is supporting Trump. And Elon Musk is the richest man in the world, and he owns, I'm not sure if how you would characterize Twitter, but it's one of the most important communication platforms in the world. And the other people as well. But with Twitter, with a lot of the money that's behind him, with important people in important positions, it makes it much more likely that he's able to successfully implement his program of reform. A large part of success in implementing any program of reform is having the right people in the right places. And so he's got some important allies and important stations, positions of power within society that can help him. And hopefully they can help him turn the small number of positions of power they have into a larger and greater numbers. And that's the Heritage Foundation's 2025 plan, I believe. They want to replace large parts of the staffing of the bureaucracy with people friendly to Trump's policy agenda. Trump has distanced himself from that program, but I'm hoping.
That was before he got shot.
Well, what I'm hoping there is that's a political maneuver and doesn't necessarily represent his real feelings about it. I think one of the problems in Trump's first term was that he was obstructed by members of his own party and by members of the non-political.
He's notoriously bad staffing. Trump is notoriously bad at picking people. And so, basically, okay, we've had 8 years. Have we fixed that problem? And it seems to be we're about to find out if that problem has been fixed.
There are people who look as if they've put a lot of thinking and work and preparation into that, including the Heritage Foundation, this Project 2025. So let's hope that that is the case.
Now, as we've already mentioned, it's been nearly a week, and we know very little in terms of details about this assassination attempt as well. Why was the Secret Service so bad? Basically, as I understand it now, we know for sure that the shooter was basically identified 30 minutes before he opened fire by members of the public, and the roof that he shot from was left open by the Secret Service Department, and the lady who ran the Secret Service protection for Trump basically said that she had identified it as a health and safety concern for her people to be on the roof, something strange like that. I mean, what was going on with the Secret Service detail? And there seemed to be quite a few small women on the team who are about half the size of Trump as well, which is a little bit hard to actually be a bodyguard for someone if you're half their size. Just lots of very, very strange things going on with the Secret Service that have enabled, I guess, a lot of conspiracy theories. I don't really blame people for coming up with dozens of different conspiracy theories about this because it's just so odd.
I can't explain all these things either, but I do know that Trump's team had been requesting additional security. I mean, he's doing a lot of rallies and he's doing a lot of public events, and his security team is working very hard. He'd been asking for additional security. And I read that on the day of this particular rally, that Biden chose to divert some of the security resources to his wife instead, who was giving a speech in Pennsylvania as well, leaving Trump's security team even more understaffed. So that's not a good look. But yeah, I can't explain all these things. I have no coherent theory about why all these things are happening. I'm left to speculate just the same as everyone else is.
I do like Scott Adams' reaction to it, or his reaction to all the theories were, don't underestimate the power of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And it's very, very possible that they simply just DEI'd themselves into this horrific situation that was so incompetent that the reason we don't know why things went wrong is just because they don't know why things went wrong, because or they do know and they're covering it up because it's part of their program to achieve equality in the Secret Service and so on. So it's weaponized incompetence seems to be the simplest explanation. Of course, there are a lot more complicated, more convoluted, more sinister theories, but at least the one that I would put forward as just being the simplest is that it was weaponized incompetence.
Well, the DEI discussion, I think, is a good one and a necessary one to come out of this. It's not to say that women security guards or women security personnel can never be good and competent, but in general, they are likely to be less suited to those sorts of roles as men. They don't possess the same size, strength. Men are built hormonally for courage and aggression more than women are. So it's less likely that women are going to have those sorts of qualities to, you know.
I can already
fire and dive on the on the president. And
I can already confirm your theories and your hypothesis here, because at the national convention, I kept a close eye on his security detail, and he had a dozen men who were larger than him, the largest men I've ever seen in my life.
Well, he's 6'3", so that'd have to be quite tall.
Oh, yeah. And and so his security team has been beefed up, and they've cleared out all these little – and there were some smaller guys as well. At, you know, if you watch the video, like his security team was – I was just surprised by how small some of those guys were on his team. And that has been completely fixed in the space of 24 hours. And every single guy on his security team is at least a couple of inches taller and wider than he is.
Well, that would put me out of that job. I mean, I don't know how tall you are, though, but I mean, I'm 5 foot tall.
No, I'm just shy of 6 feet two. Sorry, I'm actually short. Unfortunately, people often will say, "Oh, wow, dude, you're so tall." I said, "Well, actually, that's only because I'm in New Zealand. In the Netherlands, I'm about 2 inches shy of average height." That's just
the Dutch, the tallest people in the world.
People in the world, yeah. So you have to be quite tall to be average in the Netherlands. But getting to the national convention and the pick for vice president, which I believe was very, very important for Trump, and especially, as I would call it, assassination insurance to make sure nobody tries again. He had to pick someone who the mainstream media would be even more afraid of. So who could be more dangerous than Trump? And he picked a man by the name of J.D. Vance, James Vance. And I think very few people outside of the terminally online circles will have really heard of him. Like, I was very much aware of who he is, why he's so important. But do you have an explanation for listeners who perhaps have never heard of J.D. Vance, sort of explain why he might be picked by Trump and why the people on the new right, people on the online right, like myself, are very much in favor of this pick?
Well, Trump talks a lot about the forgotten men and women. And J.D. Vance literally wrote the book on the forgotten men and women. It's a book called Hillbilly Elegy, and it documents his experience growing up in sort of a rural, small town, Kentucky and Ohio. He was raised by his grandparents in sort of poor, impoverished, ruralish white communities. And the story documents a lot of the poverty and social pathologies like drug use and stuff that were really harming those communities. And it's not an overtly political book. It's more just a sort of personal book looking at the social pathologies. But what some of the conclusions that you can sort of extrapolate out of that, the effects of deindustrialization in the American heartland, the effects of some of the other policies, the stripping of human capital, the best and brightest out of these communities, and the incursion of many of the same social pathologies that plagued inner city black communities into these poor rural white communities. And so in a way, although the book is really just a sort of a personal reflection, not a book on public policy per se, but in a way it documents how the sort of mainstream liberal policy consensus of the past, 30, 40 years has has harmed some of those communities. So the free trade, for example, the overemphasis on free trade has led to the deindustrialization of the American heartland, taking away those jobs. And of course, you need jobs to have incomes, to have, a reasonable material standard of living and reasonable quality of life. A standard trade analysis of what happens when you open up, when you engage in, or you go from a closed economy to an open economy, a trade deal with another country, is that the workers in the poorer country benefit because the capital migrates to the poorer country to take advantage of the cheaper labor. But the entrepreneurs and the investor class, the wealthy in your own country benefit because they're the ones with the capital who are doing the investing in the other country. So it results in an impoverishment of your own workers and an enrichment of your own investors, so worsening inequality within your country and helping the workers in your enemy's country, or not necessarily your enemy, but in your trading partner's country. This is literally what has happened with China. You've exported the industrial base to China. Your own workers got poor, but your wealthy investors became very rich. And so the economic and trade models that economists had for forecasting what would happen forecasted exactly that before they did it. And so that's why when they made these arguments that they always had to be accompanied by a redistribution program that would take some of the benefits that accrued to the investor class and then redistribute them to the workers to make the deal fair for everyone, to make sure everyone benefited. But of course, the same people who argue for free trade also argue against these very redistribution programs that are necessary in order to justify free trade as a way of improving living standards for the broader community rather than just the wealthy few. So workers in the American heartland have been cheated. That's been a big issue for him, renegotiating some of these free trade deals, taking on China and trying to reinvigorate American manufacturing. And so there's a lot in common between J.D. Vance and Donald Trump in that area. But there's more to J.D. Vance than that as well. I mean, he's also a skeptic of mass immigration. He wants to close the border up. And a problem that Charles Murray talks about in his book, Coming Apart, is that the problem of the elites in Western societies, because of the ethic of tolerance, they no longer pass judgment on bad behavior of other people in society in order to try and, you know, those soft social sanctions are really needed in order to stop people engaging in behaviors that hurt themselves, such as drug use and having children outside wedlock and all those sorts of things. And the sort of ethic of tolerance amongst our current elite, it means that the inculcation of those cultural and moral and religious norms can't happen. The way Charles Murray puts it is our elites no longer preach what they practice, because, you know, many in the higher strata of society still tend to get married and stay married longer. They go to school, they study, they don't do drugs as much. So that is another part, that the ethic of liberal tolerance cuts against leadership and being a sort of a moral stalwart in your own community and promoting good, healthy values. And that's another factor here.
It's something I often like to point out for people, just to say the elites, the wealthy, they often will live sort of personally, privately conservative lives, and that they get married, they raise children, they keep, you know, they look after their family, and they try and build, you know, close communities and focus on safety and security for those that they love. And then, but then they promote all of the liberal policy, the ideology that they promote. If when that's adopted by the people below them, it makes it impossible for those people to ever attain to what it is that the elites have, what they're officially promoting. So there's that contradiction where they're cannibalizing their own society by promoting the very values that destroy the classes beneath them.
Yeah, I mean, they don't
practice those at all, ever.
Yeah, we've heard the idea of pulling the ladder up economically. This is like pulling the ladder up socially or culturally or morally. You know, the words of our leaders and the actions of our leaders and the example of our leaders are important in shaping the behavior of the wider mass of society. And people need to have a sense, if you're in a position of leadership or power or influence in society, you need to have a sense of what used to be called noblesse oblige to make sure that you are doing and saying and setting the right example for other people to encourage them to engage in healthy healthy behaviors rather than unhealthy ones.
Now, you hinted a little bit at why Trump would pick J.D. Vance, because he potentially will help, or he likely will help with that Rust Belt strategy. And if we look at the 2020 results, if we put all the ballot stuffing aside, the swing against Trump in these Rust Belt states in the American heartland from these rural working class white voters, especially men, was like 2 or 3 percentage points. Right? It was big enough to cost him some of those states where the people who put him into office didn't come back the second time around because he didn't really deliver for them. They felt like he did not deliver well enough for them. And it seems like he's coming back again, taking that seriously and showing them that he's taking that seriously, that he's learned his lesson and that he does want to make sure that he's delivering completely for them. And that's where it looks like Vance will be an asset to Trump with those voters. And I saw it reported in an Axios left-wing publication that they think that Vance may even help with suburban women, who Trump is considered to struggle with notoriously. And even though Vance himself is a Christian, socially conservative, I saw them claim that if the suburban women watch the Hillbilly Elegy movie, so they did a movie adaptation of his book. I haven't seen it, so I can't make a recommendation, but I'm just saying that I've seen the left-wing media report that if suburban women watch this movie, then they will like J.D. Vance. So you can, you know, clearly he will have some appeal to the voters that Trump has basically been struggling with the most.
Yeah, I mean, I think just going back to Biden doing better in those Midwest states, Biden actually has some appeal with those types of voters as well. Because he's an old white guy, he's a classic social democrat. And so that's part of the explanation, I think, for Biden doing better and Trump doing relatively worse in those, although Trump increased his vote as well overall. That's part of the explanation for Biden doing relatively better. But another one is that the so-called get out the vote effort among the inner city blacks in those swing states was incredible, almost beyond belief. He got huge turnout rates of near 100% in these inner city black communities in the big urban centres. And this, you know, spurred a lot of the, you know, the thinking about that voter fraud and that sort of thing. Because there's a lot of tricks they sort of pull. That, you know, they go and they take the voter forms around to these people's places. They ship them off. They give them a nice meal. They tell them who to vote for. The same thing that some of our friends, you know, John Tamahiri and crew, it's been revealed that they've been doing.
Yeah, I was going to say.
The Mirai scandal.
So that's very familiar.
They're sort of importing this what's been done in America for a long time.
There's an outfit in America. It was called Tammany Hall, and that was 100 years ago, I think, and they were doing that 100 years ago, and so it's been happening for a very long time.
Yeah, it's a wee bit dishonest, and, you know, especially with the mail-in voting change, it just makes those sorts of things much easier to happen, and they really need to tidy up that mail-in voting thing.
So a few states have tidied that up, but yeah, we will have to wait and see how that election turns out. Now, one of the things that the elites that I've been talking about recently, the PayPal Mafia, as we often refer to them as, and they've sort of earned that name, the founders and early employees of PayPal, very, very wealthy, and they're lovingly called the PayPal Mafia. And one of their members, Peter Thiel, and I'd forgotten his name earlier on in the show, but he's the honorary New Zealander, bought a New Zealand passport, and he bankrolled J.D. Vance's senatorial campaign. So Peter Thiel, venture capital, PayPal connection, friend of Elon Musk, he's been bankrolling Vance, and he's also going to be continuing to do that for Trump. So you can see that he's got some of these younger, wealthier men behind him who want to make sure that they've got someone who can advocate for their interests as well, but who can obviously speak to rural America and who can sort of turn things around on the right wing. And one of the other men who has been bankrolled by Thiel in the sort of, I guess, ideological space is a man by the name of Curtis Yarvin. And Yarvin and Vance are known to be good friends as well. And Yarvin used to post online under a pseudonym, Mencius Moldbug was his name. And he sort of got famous by writing an open letter to progressives. And I won't be able to detail very much of Yarvin's ideology here, but it's usually referred to as neo-reactionary theory. So if you hear the term neo-reactionary theory, that's connected with Yarvin, connected with Vance, connected with Thiel, and it's very, very popular among millennials and Zoomers on the right and conservatives and even more libertarian types as well. And it sort of is a theory around political power that the elites shape the political reality. And so it's not really the people, like democracy isn't really run by the people. It's not really run by the little guys. It's actually run by people with a lot of money and a lot of power. And it's a shift of thinking on the right about the need to have elite people in positions of power to be able to make changes. If I'm just trying to sum this up in a really simple way for listeners who may not be familiar with these ideas, I'm happy to pass this over to you, William, to comment on. But one of Garvin's ideas is what he calls the cathedral, which is basically that both the left-wing and right-wing political party are part of the same power structure compared to like a medieval cathedral. That's why he calls it the cathedral, as that was sort of the central political power structure in the medieval town. And whether or not it's the left wing or the right wing supposedly in charge, they just rotate round their inner and outer circle of the same power structure. And that it's basically impossible for people on the outside to break that power structure unless they're actually stronger than the cathedral itself. He doesn't really talk much about solutions. That's where his support for Vance comes from. And now they're trying to shift that into, okay, well, how do we apply this theory and actually make political change?
Yeah. So, I mean, Curtis Yarvin's had significant influence, I think, on the online right. The idea of the cathedral, I mean, he's memed that into existence, into the minds of, you know, political analysts on the right. The cathedral really is the structure in society, the institutions in society that shape the way people think. So the mainstream media and academia, basically the cathedral. And it's called the cathedral because it's drawing a comparison, I think, with the Catholic Church in medieval Europe, which, you know, set the cultural and the moral tone and the structure, the belief systems of the ordinary people. So he's saying that the media and academia now structure the way people think in the same way that Catholic Church did in medieval Europe. And if you can structure the way people think through political correctness, for example, as we talked about earlier in the program, if you can structure how people think, you control how they think, you can control how they vote by saying what forms of thought are acceptable and which ones are off limits, defining what's moderate and what's extreme. All that sort of behavior shapes the way people vote, and it can ultimately ensure who wields power and who doesn't, and the type of society that you live in. So it's what has been an analysis of power and power relations is something the left has traditionally done very well. Well, not traditionally, but in modern times, the last 50 to 100 years, something the left has been very good at, but the right has been woefully lacking in. Conservatives for the last 50 years or more have tended to think about abstract principles and, thought in very sort of moral terms. If you think about the way libertarianism works, it's a sort of moral theory about, you know, what's right and wrong. It's right to let people make their own decisions as long as they're not harming third parties. It's not really a structural analysis of how power works, who wields power, how they get into positions of power, and how they implement the types of policies and types of society they want to achieve. And that's the difference that Curtis Yarvin and the neo-reaction ideology makes. It's a more practical way of thinking that helps you actually bring about real change in the real world, rather than thinking about what the change ought to be in an ideal world. More Machiavellian, if you read the introduction to The Prince. Machiavelli talks about the difference between real principalities and imagined ones, and how he's going to talk about real ones rather than previous thinkers who talked about imaginary ones. So that's why it's important, I think.
Definitely something Machiavellian is there, that he's brought in a positive way. Now, when you like use Machiavellian, that was Machiavelli's entire thesis, was around how to have a positive impact and how the prince should be a positive figure, but how that sometimes might involve people from the outside saying, oh, those things are not very nice, but that ultimately they're necessary for the greatest amount of good to be able to be exercised by a Christian prince. And a lot of the ideas introduced in neo-reactionary theory as well come from a German jurist by the name of Carl Schmitt as well. And I've seen many arguments that the left basically operates on the principles that Carl Schmitt put forward. Ultimately, you know, what matters is power. And then, you know, arguing, like, as you've just said, arguing about, oh, well, this is what the moral thing should be, this is what the law should be. It's really about the exercise of power. And basically, Yarvin is trying to introduce that idea to the right wing. And you're seeing someone now in the United States at a very high level, vice presidential candidate, who sort of subscribes to that way of thinking, which is theoretically a more successful way to deal with political change and to have the focus on how to acquire power and how to use it to benefit your people, the people who are supporting you and the people who are your friends, essentially. And that's what's going to be the thing that Vance brings to the table for the people who have been watching him on the sidelines for the last few years.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I can't actually speak to how, I mean, I've never heard J.D. Vance talking about neo-reactionary theory, but I mean, if assuming he has these associations, I mean, he must have some familiarity with it. And if you look at all these things happening in the background, like we've discussed earlier, the 2025 project and what the Heritage Foundation is doing there, the focus on getting people into positions of power to make a difference, the talk about having this, you know, and the practice of having this counter-elite, which, you know, Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and people like this would be a part of, it certainly looks as if people are thinking and acting in that way. So
I'll just quickly read out this interview that he did recently, because you said, does he speak like this? Well, here's a quote from him on an interview where he said, I think that You know, we should seize the institutions of the left and turn them against the left. What we need is a de-bathification program, a de-wokeification program, referring here to the, I guess, the deconstruction of the Iraqi regime. And he said this is before he was, you know, this is, I think, from last year, because he said, I think Trump is going to run again in 2024. And what I think that Trump should do, if I was giving him one piece of advice, fire every single mid-level bureaucrat, every civil servant in the administrative state, and replace them with our people. And then he says, when the courts try to stop you, you stand before the country and say, quoting Andrew Jackson, the Chief Justice has made his ruling, now let him enforce it. So that's from DJ Vance. And he says, he follows this up with, we are in a late Republican period. And the author says here, evoking the common new right view of America as Rome awaiting its Caesar. Going back to quoting Vance here, if we're going to push back against it, we're going to have to get pretty wild and pretty far out there and go in directions that a lot of conservatives right now are uncomfortable with, end quote. So that's the way that he speaks in interviews. So I think that does line up with what we've been talking about.
You're right, it does, yeah. I once heard Curtis Yarvin give a presentation about the RAGE principle, R-A-G-E, Retire All Government Employees, where he argued that the first day the president gets into office, he should sign an executive order to get rid of all the people. So this is very much in line with the way this type of thinking goes.
All right, well, I think that's about it for dealing with the American issues. It's only taken us about 50 minutes, so that's not too bad. I do think this was the bulk of what happened this week, so I don't feel bad committing almost the entire weekly roundup to it. But if you've got anything that you think I've omitted to raise on this, or you're happy for me to move on to talk about Christopher Luxon?
Now let's move on.
So Luxon was at the NATO summit in the past week, and he made a couple of comments about our relationship with China and America. This is somewhat relevant, I think, as well to Trump's foreign policy. And Luxon basically said that he wants to call out China for spying more often, because, you know, New Zealand's been very timid with regards to that. He also wants to be able to sign a deal with the Philippines and deploy more military assets from New Zealand to the Philippines. He also wants to join the US and Australia in conducting joint military exercises, and really sees New Zealand being a force multiplier for Australia and the United States. So he wants to very openly now realign ourselves with NATO, with the United States, with Australia. He's dedicated over $130 million to Ukraine and reaffirmed his commitments, New Zealand's commitments to supporting Ukraine. And this has resulted in Helen Clark and Don Brash being quite unhappy with the China comments in particular, that they say this threatens New Zealand's independent foreign policy, and they don't like him allying us so openly with the United States. Yeah. Now, I guess, yeah, I'd be keen to hear your comments on that.
Well, as we've sort of discussed before, I mean, I see the world, we're moving from the age of America being the world's sole superpower and back towards an age of geopolitical competition. And I see basically a US and NATO-led Western bloc against a Russia and China-led Eurasian bloc, and those being the two big geopolitical centers of power. And it looks as if America, UK, NATO are trying to rope in other allies, including in the Pacific, which is our region, to try and counterbalance Chinese influence in the area. And it looks like they're courting Luxon. Luxon is responding, or is willing to try and move ever so slowly, ever so carefully, more towards closer security relationships with their traditional allies, the US and NATO. Well, kind of NATO is a traditional ally, kind of, but the US, UK and Australia. So that's how I see it going. They're trying to have it both ways a little bit, the government. I think they're trying to move closer to the US while trying to say, oh no, we're still kind of independent, floating in between here. And if you were going to try and move closer to the US, it probably is wise to do it that way, because we are still reliant on China. It's our biggest trading partner. And it's a lot, especially for our agricultural exports, and they take a large proportion of those. So we do have to be very careful with that relationship. But yeah, I mean, it's an open question for me whether the move to align ourselves more with the US, Australia, UK, NATO is really the wise move or the move we should be making. And, I would have been more open and supportive of a move in times gone by. But the way things are right now, I mean, I have pretty serious questions about the leadership of the US and NATO, the governing institutions, whom I see as not necessarily governing in the best interests of their own people. So while I feel some sort of fellow feeling and some commonality with the people of the US and Europe, I'm not sure that the governments and the institutional power really accurately represents them.
Yes, on that subject, moving over to the European Union, it was revealed this week as well by Elon Musk, again, in more detail, because he has talked about it before, but they united, the European Union offered him a deal to censor people, which they had been demanding, and he had spoken openly about this before. So they came back to him and said, okay, how about you censor these people quietly without telling anyone, and then we'll let you off the hook. So you don't have to publicly comply, but if you go and privately comply with our request to censor these people, then we'll leave you alone. And so you see the European Union basically still doubling down on its censorship efforts, even when it's confronted very openly, as they have been by Elon.
Yeah, very censorious, very bad for freedom, those sorts of moves. But the improvement that I see there is that this is really the sort of thing that the Twitter files and those revelations told us was happening beforehand anyway. It's just we were never being told about it before. But now it feels like we're getting more information about these deals being proposed and being made. So that in itself is progress, I think.
And then another piece of free speech, at least an issue around free speech, the Compact magazine has been banned in Germany. Its offices were raided just a few days ago, and I'm not sure if they arrested the printers or the editors of the magazine, but they definitely properly raided their houses, and they basically banned the magazine itself from Germany. What is in the Compact magazine? What's so special about it? Is it that much of a threat to Germany? They basically banned it as a threat to national security.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a so-called far-right magazine. Really, I mean, it talks about itself as being a defender of German sovereignty, using this sort of language. But the issue, the reason that they've banned it, and it's been removed completely from the internet.
Yeah.
The reason
they
banned
it. Completely based in Germany, right? So they just nuked it, just gone.
It's gone. Yeah. And they raided all the people's offices, took their hard drives, all this sort of thing. Their magazine had an editorial line that they had an ethnic definition of what a German person was, right? So that they're defining what it means to be German in ethnic terms. And the argument from the minister from the interior, I think her title was, I can't remember her name off the top of my head. She seems to be arguing that something along the lines of defining a German person in ethnic terms is a breach of the US, not the US, the German constitution in some sort of way, because the German constitution defends the rights of minorities and ensures you're not allowed to discriminate against minorities. So they're calling the behavior of the magazine unconstitutional on those grounds, and it's all around this ethnic definition of what a German is. And this has been criticized, and this is obviously a huge deal for free speech. It's a massive censorship undertaking.
it's been criticized. I saw it reported as the greatest action taken against the free press in Germany since World War II. I think the first time they've just straight up banned an entire segment of the free press, really.
It's very ironic that we're going to save Germany from Nazis by behaving exactly like Nazis and censoring all our political opponents and acting like the secret police and raiding them and taking them away.
So in a little bit, when I looked at this, I saw one of the possible justifications given that they were a little bit pro-German, or they had like a Marxist, it was kind of supposed to be about like conservatives and Marxists who are both running the magazine as well. It sounded a little bit funky. I don't know if it's something that you know on that particular angle, whether or not there was any connections there with supposedly connections to Marxism and to Russia.
I haven't looked into it in depth, but it's a pro-worker conservative magazine. So it has some things in common with, we were just talking about populism in the US. Mm-hmm. It's less of the free market conservatism, more of the pro-worker conservatism.
Well, thank you for that. And locally in free speech issues as well, we've had a few positive developments, at least one positive development, I think, from the Otago University have actually issued a statement on free speech. I hope you came across this. I mean, this is really your area of interest. So what do you think of the University of Otago's free speech statement?
Well, I think it's a very positive and strong statement in defense of free speech and academic freedom. And it's really good that we're getting this sort of thing, because a lot of New Zealand's universities have been less than optimal in this area. If you need free speech anywhere and the ability to make arguments, and no matter how unpopular or frowned upon or disliked, if you need that ability anywhere in order to drive the production of knowledge forward, it's in the university. Universities are really the engines of much of what we call progress. And I know people on the right often...
no progress. We don't want any of that.
The idea of progress. But progress can mean different things. And so there's social progress, but there's also scientific, technological, and economic progress. And those latter three, I think, are types of progress that people on the right can embrace. Things, the accrual of scientific knowledge is something that happens. As long as you don't destroy burn all the books or, take down the internet, burn all the libraries, then destroy the places where knowledge is stored, then or refuse to educate people so that the knowledge can be transferred and learned, then the potential exists for the knowledge to accumulate and accrue and grow and build upon itself, such that, our technology and our economy and material standards of living can continue to grow and improve, so long as that process is allowed to continue. But that requires free speech and the ability to challenge ideas. You can't overturn existing scientific paradigms, existing ways of understanding the world, if you get burned at the stake when you suggest them. And so it's important to allow free speech for that reason. Because often new and revolutionary ideas, they come from heretics, and you need to have some sort of tolerance for the heretics and ability for them to put their ideas forward in order for new understandings to emerge and take hold and make everyone's lives better.
Now, there's also been a few, arguments, debates back and forth on neutrality, political neutrality in the university. And I guess it will be interesting to hear from you how that interacts with freedom of speech. So there have been, a number of issues on the university campus, especially recently around the Treaty of Waitangi, around Gaza, several protests, and whether or not there has been censorship there in the New Zealand universities, I'm not 100% familiar on, but I see that debate escalating whether or not these universities should be politically neutral, or whether it's a restriction on their freedom of speech to argue that they should be neutral in the sense.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a sort of sleight of hand going on there, allowing the university itself to take a position versus the people within the university.
Exactly. Yeah.
Being able to take a position.
I had the answer as soon as I asked the question. I thought, oh, well, yeah, the university, that's the problem, isn't it? Yeah.
But the Treaty of Waitangi would be the big thing there. So, and this is a similar problem to what we saw with the mainstream media in New Zealand as a result of the Public Interest Journalism Fund, where they tried to sneak in adherence to the treaty and treaty principles in various ways as a condition of receiving Public Interest Journalism Fund money. And the problem with that is that the treaty is a live political issue, which you have people on various sides of the debate on. And the media is unable to remain neutral and report both of those sides fairly if they've signed up to some agreement that requires them to take a particular line on it. And that way of thinking also goes for the universities. How can they remain neutral towards people who are skeptical of the treaty or who make arguments that we ought to abolish the treaty or that we shouldn't use the treaty principles? Now, these are all legitimate points of view that have their merits or their dismerits. But in a university, you should be able to make those arguments at the very least. And it makes it very difficult to make those sorts of arguments if the treaty's sort of embedded in and is an expectation of your work and your research and the way your educational courses are run and all these sorts of things.
Well, that's just about it for this week. We are out of time, and well, we're actually a bit over time in terms of the target here, but there has been so much to talk about this week. It has been one of those weeks in politics where sometimes it feels like a year's worth of stuff has happened. I'll just mention on the treaty obligations here as well, we did have a development this week there that David Seymour ordered Pharmac to remove their treaty obligations, and or at least consideration of it in whatever documents that they use to claim that they need to review treaty obligations and in how they order medicines. I'm not even sure how that was supposed to work, but again, I don't think it was supposed to work. I think it's just supposed to be bureaucratic nonsense to allow them to spend money and rearrange power for nefarious ends. So there is some development there in terms of that promise that the coalition agreement has that, you know, all of that treaty stuff is going to be removed from the remits of these government departments, and that allows them to do all kinds of effectively really like censorship of dissent in terms of personnel, I think, just like the universities do. They use it as a sort of a litmus test of who's allowed to hold a certain position in the same way that perhaps pronouns and other elements of the diversity, equity, inclusion programs are used to sort of keep conservatives out of key positions. So it's just great to see that development happen as well. That's going to be it. Thank you for joining me on the show this week, William. And we will look forward to chatting with you again. There won't be a roundup next week, but we will be back in the first week of August.
Thanks, Dewa.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.